From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Lumberton, North Carolina is a city of 21,000 people that many Americans had never heard of until this week when it became one of the places worst hit by Hurricane Matthew. And there are warnings that life-threatening flooding from swollen rivers will continue for days. Joining us now is Linda Oxendine, Director of Public Services in Lumberton. Thanks for joining us. And first, give us a sense of how bad the flooding is there right now.
The flooding is pretty bad. We've pretty much shut down entry into our city. At the current, we have two entry points, but we're in the process of setting down one of those entry points. So we're trying to figure out a second alternate route. We're still conducting rescues, and they're in the process of trying to determine a route for our folk that need to get in our city to do transport and or bring supplies to us to enter our city easily.
And when you talk about rescues, are those being done by helicopter, by boat? How are you doing those?
By both, actually. They're being done by motorized boat because the current is really bad. We can't get paddle boats in the waters, and helicopters as well.
And we've heard that this could get worse, the flooding could get worse later this week because of rising rivers. Is that a concern for you?
It definitely is always a concern. However, the water has receded just a bit when we came in today, so we're praying that that continues to happen. However, if the water does not recede and continues to elevate, we're certainly prepared to take care of our community.
What else do you need right now from the state and federal government for help?
We've had direct contact with our governor here in North Carolina. He's been very active in the process. In fact, he just visited on yesterday a neighboring town. We're getting food transported in. We're getting blankets for our folk at the shelters. We could also use cots because we have numerous people located in the shelters that we have set up, not only just here in Lumberton, but throughout our county. And aftermath, of course, we'll probably need folk to kind of help us out with resources so we can reset up homes. We've had several people that have been totally flooded, lost homes, have been displaced. And anything the community can bring to us in the form of support, non-perishable good items, we are available to take anything they have.
Now, you're from the area originally. Have you ever seen anything like this before? What's it like for you personally to see this kind of flooding?
I'm in shock, and I'm honored when we look out and we see that countries such as Haiti are praying for Robeson County. It really grips our heart. I am a native of Lumberton, grew up right here in the city limits. It's my home. I'm a 30-year veteran with the city of Lumberton, and they can't run me away because, again, I love my city. We are truly an all-American city, and I think we're showing that right now with the way our people are coming together with city government, county government, the state of North Carolina. We've really united. We've been flooded with calls from even surrounding cities all over the nation that are bringing in or saying, hey, how can we get these good items to you all? That we can help our people here in our community rebuild their homes.
Well, Linda, our thoughts are with you there in Lumberton. Best of luck as you deal with the aftermath of this storm. That's Linda Oxendine, Director of Public Services in Lumberton, North Carolina. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, arresting judges without evidence would seem like a shocking violation of constitutional democracy, but that's exactly what happened in Turkey. A state of emergency declared after that unsuccessful coup in July led to the arrest of over 2,700 judges and prosecutors because their names appear on a list of suspected members or alleged associates of a suspected terrorist group. Now, some of those Turkish jurists have received training from a group of judges in the U.S. who've been promoting the rule of law overseas. As David Boeri of Here and Now contributor WBUR in Boston reports, participation in the American training programs may be one of the reasons the Turkish judges came under suspicion.
Former Justice Robert Cordy is worried sick about the fate of the judges he helped train in Turkey and in Boston. They've been fired, jailed, or gone missing.
It's devastating. I don't think anything has ever devastated me more than seeing this happen to people that I have come to know, love, respect. It is just beyond the pale.
For the last 15 years, Cordy served as a justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. The state constitution he helped interpret enshrines the concept, coined by President John Adams, of a government of laws and not men, where judges are independent and no one is above the law.
So creating a rule of law society where people can depend on courts as a place to get justice is really an important part of what we try to do and what we try to help those judiciaries do.
Cordy and federal judges Richard Stearns and Mark Wolf regularly travel overseas to countries with a history of authoritarian rule and courts tainted by favoritism, false testimony, and fabricated evidence. In Turkey, they've shared best practices and philosophy. Turkey, in turn, has sent judges to America for language and legal training.
Judges in Turkey and elsewhere are inspired by our example.
As a young prosecutor, Mark Wolf helped reform the Justice Department after the clandestine crimes and cover-ups of the Nixon administration. Later, as a federal judge, he demanded government accountability for its protection of mobster Whitey Bulger, another case foreign judges are familiar with.
They know about it in Turkey and in the Czech Republic and in Russia because it is the role of judges in the United States, as I say, to find the facts in certain circumstances, apply the law, and to come out with decisions uninfluenced by fear or favor.
Wolf and Cordy describe their younger Turkish counterparts as the best and brightest. But in July came the catastrophe. After a military coup attempt on the 15th, the government of Recep Tayyip Erdogan blamed it on his former colleague, the exiled cleric Fethullah Gulen, who was labeled a terrorist. Calling the uprising a gift from God, Erdogan launched a counter-coup against the Gulenists.
Within hours of the coup attempt failing, there were basically lists of names issued to arrest or detain certain judges and prosecutors.
Emma Sinclair Webb is the director of Human Rights Watch in Turkey. She describes a massive purge of judges, civil servants, and teachers.
The point is the lack of process in all of this. It literally seems to have been that they were names on a list, so there was no discussion of criminal wrongdoing. It was rather guilt by association. There was an assumption that all of these people were supporters of the US-based Fethullah Gulen, and that therefore that was the crime.
Over 3,600 judges and prosecutors were suspended. At least 2,700 of them were jailed. And lawyers who might defend them were also arrested. Again, Robert Cordy.
Families have been destroyed. Assets of thousands of families of judges and prosecutors just seized. Many of them are in jail waiting for hearings that will never be due process hearings, as far as I can tell. This is the world turned upside down.
In Boston, judges and lawyers have tried desperately to account for the status and whereabouts of their Turkish colleagues. Judge Wolf shows me photos of a judge's young children. He reads the man's last message.
The news are not well. I was examining a list of judges and prosecutors removed from their post. I am in it. The government issued an arrest warrant, so this mail may be my last message for a while. Please pray for me and my country.
The Turkish government of President Erdogan says the judges are where they are because of their links to and support of the alleged terrorist organization it accuses Gulen of running from his exile in Pennsylvania.
This is not a political purge. Turkey is not on a winch hunt.
Ömer Budak, the Turkish consul general in Boston, says his government acted to defend its national security and its democracy. He depicts Gulenists as an organized crime syndicate and international cult that operates by stealth. And he accuses those targeted judges of themselves subverting the rule of law.
Their key tactic is concealment, and they are also ordered to infiltrate all critical state institutions in Turkey, armed forces, police, intelligence, economic institutions, as well as judiciary.
Judges Wolf and Cordy scoff at the idea that the judges they worked with were Gulenists or terrorists. Cordy claims they will be denied due process.
I can't imagine there's a single judge or prosecutor in Turkey that would ever rule against the government, because with this hanging over their head, they would be next, and they know that. And that's the worst part of this.
Wolf cites a familiar scenario for authoritarian leaders.
In Henry VI, Shakespeare has Jake the Butcher say that when we succeed in this rebellion, the first thing we'll do is kill the lawyers, meaning we don't want people to advocate for the rule of law when we get power.
And this takes it one step further, Wolf says, by disabling those judges who might have proclaimed, "We are a government of laws and not men," with President Erdogan seen as a critical ally of the West in the war against ISIS. Judges Wolf and Cordy say that the U.S. State Department has been noticeably quiet on the subject of the Turkish judges. A reminder, perhaps, that not everyone shares the same enthusiasm as the judges do in advocating for the rule of law. For Here and Now, I'm David Boeri.
For the second presidential cycle in a row, Scientific American magazine has partnered with ScienceDebate.org to find out where the presidential candidates stand on science. The questions were developed and refined through a crowdsourcing of dozens of scientific organizations representing more than 10 million scientists. The answers were graded on a point system on three criteria. Did they address the question? Were they informed with respect to scientific consensus? And did they have workable details? Christine Gorman is a senior editor at Scientific American. She oversaw the process, which became a 47-page long article titled Grading the Candidates on Science. It includes everything from climate change to immigration. We'll ask about that and link you at hereandnow.org as Christine joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Hi.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
I'm fine. And first of all, just give us an overview. How would you say, is there a way that you could, in one sentence, compare the leading candidates, Hillary Clinton's responses to Donald Trump's responses? Is there something that appeared across the board?
Oh, there's no question that Hillary Clinton's answers were far and away much better than Donald Trump's. She had a clear grasp of facts, was clearly based in the world of objective truth. And unfortunately, Donald Trump's were not.
Well, and you had passing grades for each. How many did each get?
Well, we actually ended up grading them on a score of 0 to 5, which is what we did 4 years ago when we graded Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, who were then running. 4 years ago, those two candidates were very close. In this case, 4 years later, it's astonishing. Hillary Clinton scored 64 points on our 0 to 5 scale. Donald Trump scored 7.
We should say you sent the questions to Gary Johnson and Jill Stein. Johnson got 30 points, Stein 44. So she was up there as well. But let's start with climate change. There's something immediately notable in his response. Donald Trump puts the phrase climate change in quotes.
Yes. And this is the sort of thing that a candidate does to indicate to his base that he's not really treating it as something that is real and serious and dangerous.
Well, he says there's still much that needs to be investigated in the field of, quote, climate change. Perhaps we should use our limited financial resources in making sure everyone has clean water. Perhaps we should focus on eliminating lingering diseases around the world like malaria.
To suggest that in a time of limited financial resources, you can't deal with climate change, but you can deal with clean water and malaria efforts just shows a fundamental lack of understanding of the issue. If you think about what is happening already in some of the high-altitude tropical areas where malaria is going up the side of the mountain because of the warmer weather and wetter atmosphere, that is already happening as a result of the 1 degree increase Celsius over the last 100 years in average global temperature. So to suggest that don't focus on climate change because we want to do this other thing over here that actually is partly dependent on climate change shows what he still doesn't get.
Well, Hillary Clinton and her response and all her responses earns her reputation as a wonk. She sets out paragraphs of suggestions, a $60 billion clean energy challenge to partner with states, cities, and rural communities, take the lead on clean energy, build on the range of pollution and efficiency standards, clean energy tax incentives. When I asked you what a difference between the two candidates might be, one that really becomes clear as you read all the answers is that Hillary Clinton is very willing to use the government to get involved in some of these science issues. Donald Trump is less so.
That's true. And I think you have to ask yourself, what is government for? And I think at a minimum, we can all, no matter what political persuasion we might be, accept that government is there to protect us from threats, foreign and domestic. And I would say that when there's something that's so overwhelmingly large, as climate change is, as energy policy is, as international pandemics are, you really do need the convening power of government working with business to address some of those challenges. I mean, we didn't beat back smallpox without having an international organization.
Well, let's look at some of the other issues. You mentioned energy. Hillary Clinton, page and a half response. Donald Trump, one paragraph. And here it's very clear. You know, she says, we're going to have half a billion solar panels installed by the end of my first term, cut energy waste, launch a $60 billion clean energy challenge to partner with states, cities. Again, the government cutting carbon pollution, expanding clean energy, especially for low-income families. His one graph makes, again, that distinction. He says a thriving market system will allow consumers to determine the best sources of energy for future consumption. So, again, that distinction, get the government involved with programs, get the government out of it, let the market do it. It's amazing to us, Christine, how many categories are now under science, you know, the internet, mental health. What's another category where something really, a difference really jumped out at you?
What we really want to emphasize is that these are not just trick questions somehow. It's an open book test. The point is really to see whether or not there's an acceptance of objective reality. You might want things to be a different way, but science gives you a set of tools, for example, with cigarette smoking and lung cancer. Similarly, we know that fracking, for example, you know, here this comes under energy policy, and we're already seeing this in Oklahoma and Texas, that fracking is causing an increase in seismic activities in those states. When you say the market, does the market care whether an earthquake hits Dallas or Tulsa? No. That's up to governments and elected officials, and the people can have a say in working with the evidence showing that there is a problem here. The point is you take the science and you work with what has been shown to you. You don't say, oh, the market's going to take care of everything, because the market doesn't know about geology, for example.
Well, Donald Trump doesn't always assign responsibility to the markets. It's fascinating that the opioid crisis is included in this science questionnaire. You asked how the candidates would enlist researchers, doctors, pharmaceutical companies to help. Donald Trump talked about not letting drugs in.
That was a big surprise to me because, of course, the opioid crisis, for the most part in the United States, is an issue of prescription drugs and prescription drugs being the gateway to, so we're talking about fentanyl and others that are more powerful than illegal heroin or other illicit drugs.
Well, some of those drugs are coming from other countries,
right.
The fentanyl, the synthetic. What did the candidate say about vaccines?
Well, there it seemed that the question, which was also part of the 2012 set of questions on vaccination, is important because there is kind of an anti-vaccine movement. And this is something you see more on the left than on the right, this idea that vaccines somehow cause autism, which has been consistently shown not to have any basis. Clinton clearly accepts the importance of vaccines, talks about how to make them better, and how to educate parents about vaccines. Trump said basically that what the government is already doing was fine, but he has also this history of anti-vaccine statements, which comes back once again to you have to accept the science, you have to accept the evidence.
You asked them about education, the internet, cybersecurity, but also immigration. Why? How does immigration fit into science?
There are 20 questions, and we actually analyzed the answers to all 20 questions. We did not grade the one on immigration. So why in a set of questions about science is there a question about immigration? That's largely because of the H-1B visa program, which brings in a lot of computer scientists and engineers. That's the science angle of it.
Well, interestingly, Donald Trump says if we allow individuals in this country legally to get their educations, we should let them stay if they want to contribute to our economy. It makes no sense to kick them out of the country right after they achieve such extraordinary goals. In that way, he agrees with her.
Right.
Is there anything Donald Trump, I mean, it's obviously he didn't have the respect for the science that you would have liked to see, but was there any place where he really surprised you?
The one place where he really surprised me was in the question about oceans and ocean health, where he did not mention oceans or fish or coastlines or anything. It was just like, I give up on this one.
I was actually looking for one where he pleasantly surprised you with maybe more knowledge about science or, an answer that dovetailed with the current science.
I was gratified that he recognized how much mental health is an issue in the prison population. That would be fair.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of people realize that.
By the way, what did he talk about in the oceans segment, if not oceans or coastlines? What was the...
Basically, he said, you know, see all my other answers for an idea of what I would do.
That's Christine Gorman, senior editor at Scientific American. They partnered with ScienceDebate.org for the second presidential election in a row. They presented the candidates with 20 questions about science. We'll link you to the answers at hereandnow.org. Christine, thank you.
Pleasure.
Now, Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson submitted answers. He said he pledged to scrutinize all funding with an eye to reducing spending, but he supports limited funding for applied science that has a clear public benefit. That's Libertarian. Green Party candidate Jill Stein, who again scored very well, said we should label GMOs and support organic and regenerative agriculture and put a moratorium on pesticides until proven safe.
As U.S. military operations continue in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan, it turns out demand is far outpacing the supply of fighter pilots needed for those missions. Officials are calling it the pilot shortage. They say it's a crisis, and an Air Force training base in Arizona has been tapped to help solve it. Casey Kuhn of Here and Now contributor KJZZ reports.
Three F-16 fighter jets take off at Luke Air Force Base just west of Phoenix. Today, the pilots are practicing combat exercises and techniques. Colonel David Shoemaker says putting more new pilots through this training will help address a looming fighter pilot shortage. But at this rate, the Air Force cannot keep up with the number of experienced pilots leaving.
It's not a mass exodus, but there are enough getting out that we're going to have to overcome that by upping that production.
About 300 fighter pilots trained at Luke last year, but of those, only about a third are first-time pilots. The rest are being pulled out of service jobs or haven't flown for a few years. Shoemaker says officials saw the shortage coming, but were not anticipating such a drastic drop in numbers.
While we do have a shortage now, what we're really concerned about, what we're really harping on is if we continue to do this the way we're doing it, the shortage by 2022 is going to be extremely alarming.
In the past 5 years, more than 500 pilots have left the Air Force. Meanwhile, pilot jobs have been added, widening the gap between active pilots and open pilot positions. That leaves about 700 fighter pilot jobs empty this year alone. Officials are worried that number will keep dropping and the front lines will take a hit. Here's Major General Scott Vanderham, Deputy Chief of Staff, U.S. Air Force Operations.
It's a crisis right now because if unmitigated, in less than 18 months, we won't have enough fighter pilots even to fill the combat frontline squadrons. And at the same time, we thought that we would be out of certain engagements around the world, which we're not.
The question is how to retain experienced pilots once the option to leave the service comes up. It can be difficult when commercial airlines are hiring more, offer more pay and more stability. But Vanderham says the Air Force is turning to Congress this year for incentives.
Currently, at the end of their commitment, they're offered a pilot bonus of $25,000 a year, and we're asking for an increase in that, a significant increase, to $48,000 to $50,000 a year.
Major Brian Healy is a reserve fighter pilot at Luke Air Force Base. He directs operations of a fighter squadron and chose to leave active duty when the option came up. The decision wasn't easy.
It was a very painful process to get out or to stay in.
For Healy, being in the reserves was the best choice for stability in his life. And he says a lot of his peers left for similar reasons.
In the Guard and Reserve, you have a lot more consistency. You have a lot more control over when you deploy, which I think is a big factor. You just have a lot more control over your life.
He doesn't think the pilot shortage crisis can be solved just with higher bonuses, but it's a start.
it's going to take a long, long time to change the direction of the ship, if you will. Right now, I'd say the best thing they could do is probably throw money at it.
Air Force officials expect it to take 5 to 10 years before there is a fully staffed force. In the meantime, Luke Air Force Base and other bases are expected to train more fighter pilots while working to retain active pilots already on hand. For Here and Now, I'm Casey Kuhn in Phoenix.
Many people who find themselves addicted to prescription pain pills have their first experience with opioids during and directly after surgery. But did they need those doses? Blake Farmer of Here and Now contributor WPLN in Nashville reports on a school trying to get opioids out of the operating room.
Chris Hewlin is president of the Middle Tennessee School of Anesthesia, which trains more than two-thirds of the nurse anesthetists who practice in the Nashville area. And today he's wearing sandals around the office.
I recently had surgery on my left foot.
I did wonder why you were wearing Birkenstocks.
I'm just that cool.
Really, this foot surgery was a golden opportunity for Hewlin to play the patient. The school has started teaching how to give nerve blocks. So instead of knocking him out, the anesthesia team numbed a particular nerve that deadened his whole leg. That meant he was wide awake.
Said hi to the surgeon a couple times during the case. We conversed. Felt zero pain. Didn't have any sensation in my foot for 24 hours.
And after that, instead of potentially addictive narcotics, ibuprofen did the trick. This is where the school sees opportunity. Patrick Moss teaches acute pain management here and says surgery is often the starting point for dependence and even addiction.
We want to eliminate or potentially decrease the probability that the patient's going to be exposed to those opiates for the very first time.
There it is. Kyle Benge squeezes goop on his portable ultrasound device and slips it down the neck of a fellow student while watching a monitor.
So for this block here, we're looking at the shoulder and upper arm.
Binge pinpoints the relevant nerve. After numbing it up with a needle, a patient would be ready to go under the knife. Improvements in imaging technology are what have made nerve blocks more practical. Still, they haven't caught on widely. These techniques are kind of foreign to older practitioners. In fact, the Middle Tennessee School of Anesthesia has had some trouble finding operating rooms where students can practice their nerve blocks.
Adoption of that may be limited by the specialist that you have in your hospital.
Anesthesiologist David Edwards of Vanderbilt Medical Center is a nerve block believer. He regularly uses regional numbing, but says he understands the hesitancy. They can sound intimidating to patients, and patients who receive nerve blocks need more monitoring.
Definitely requires a support team when you decide as a hospital to use these kinds of techniques, because what if it isn't completely helping the pain? What's your backup plan?
But Edwards believes a move toward precision anesthesia could chip away at the persistent pain pill problem in Tennessee and the nation. For Here and Now, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
Well, today, Russian planes began once again bombing Syria's East Aleppo. Aleppo is the city divided between supporters of Russian-backed President Assad and those who want to overthrow him. Today, CBS's Elizabeth Palmer managed to get inside Aleppo and noted that until today's bombings, there'd been a lull.
But weeks of punishing airstrikes before that killed hundreds and also left seriously wounded people, including children, trapped inside besieged neighborhoods with no way out.
Well, the BBC recently received footage showing what those trapped, wounded people are enduring. It was filmed inside a filthy, blood-drenched underground hospital. BBC correspondent John Sweeney joins us from London. And John, tell us more about this video.
Well, essentially, the window was provided by Dr. David Knott. He's a British surgeon who went to Aleppo in 2014, and he taught a number of young Syrian doctors to do essentially battlefield surgery. And they send him film, they tell him what he's doing, and they ask for his advice. And a couple of weeks ago, we filmed an amazing operation where a man was given a new jaw. It had been blasted by a Russian bomb.
Well, actually, we saw that in your report. In that case, this doctor, by Skype, talked the surgeons, the doctors in Syria through that surgery.
Yes, he effectively used Skype and WhatsApp, an amazing digital media, to break the siege of Aleppo. He talked the doctors in Syria through this surgery. And this was, I believe, a world first, using digital technology to allow him to guide the doctors in Syria so that they could operate on this man and effectively save his life. And then, as a result, they would carry on sending him film clips. What happened was the hospital was targeted by Russian cluster bombs. I say that with confidence because the doctors sent pictures of the cluster bombs, some of which had actually landed very close to the hospital, and on them clearly was Shoab 0.5M, which is a telltale sign of a well-known Russian cluster bomb manufacturer. Basically, these are dozens of balls the size of a grapefruit are dropped from a Russian plane, and when they land, most explode and ball bearings sort of spat out. And the doctors showed us a little boy with a ball bearing in his spine. Another had gone in through the back of the kid's head and lodged behind his nose. And there was a third patient, and they took the ball bearing from just by his liver. The doctors took it out, and you could see that on the clip.
Actually, we have that clip. Again, what you're seeing on the footage is the cavity as the body is open. You see the hands of the doctor, tweezers, and you see this silver ball bearing in the liver. Let's listen.
Actually, we are trying to extract it without injuring the elements of Borahibaris.
Oh my gosh.
This is the fragment here, actually. This is from a cluster bomb.
And at that point, you see the ball bearing pulled out with the tweezers. John Sweeney, you also say there is very graphic footage that's coming out that you couldn't put in your report. Things like children decapitated by rubble. And that's a serious problem, that we can't show that.
No, we get complaints if we broadcast the true images of this war. And the difficulty I have as a reporter is that we are in danger of giving Mr. Putin and Mr. Assad a bit of a pass on exactly what they're doing. Now, the problem is Hollywood, you know, you see explosions, you see machine guns. You do not see a ball bearing in a child's spine. But that is the truth about war.
So you're pushing to force these images to make people see what's actually happening. But, you know, we saw the little boy drowned on the beach, the other sitting quietly in an ambulance, limp bodies of infants being lifted from rubble by these heroic, self-appointed local rescuers, the white helmets. You know, is a decapitation going to make that much difference? You know, it just feels like nothing's working. And as Elizabeth Palmer points out today, the UN, Doctors Without Borders are all pushing for a ceasefire so that these wounded can at least leave. Doesn't seem like it's going to happen.
No, the situation is beyond bleak in East Aleppo. But essentially, it feels to me the people who say, let's not put anything offensive or distasteful on air to broadcast, have overwhelmed the argument. We need to push back. But also there is the wider argument, and it's very simple, is Assad's narrative, his mantra, is it's either me or so-called Islamic State. Hmm. There is a third way, the people who want the democratic, civilized Syria. Now, for the moment, their voice is constricted. They're not exactly silenced, but it's throttled by the siege. And I feel that we should pay attention to these people by overly sanitizing these images. We're not seeing enough of the reality of the war, and our politicians, our political masters, are not doing enough to put pressure on, for example, Mr. Putin, who's helping Mr. Assad. So I'm not suggesting, I don't think it's sensible to suggest military action, but, for example, there are a lot of rich Russians who live in the States and in Britain. Now, one could think perhaps of more sanctions. One could push the envelope a little bit further their way. At the moment, there's an MP called Andrew Mitchell who today, as we speak in the House of Commons, has compared what the Russians are doing in Syria to what the Nazis did at Guernica in the Spanish Civil War. You'll remember the Picasso painting.
Massacre, yeah. So that is starting. BBC correspondent John Sweeney in London. We'll link you to his story. You can see those images in Aleppo at herenow.org. John, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And if you go there to see the video, again, it's very graphic images. But your thoughts as well. Sanctions against wealthy Russians. What can be done in Syria? We'd love to hear from you at hereandnow.org.
Today, Samsung announced it is permanently discontinuing its signature smartphone, the Galaxy Note 7. The decision to end production came after more reports of the phones catching fire, including the replacement model that the company put out after the first reports. The move comes as an embarrassment to the smartphone giant and leaves it without a high-end rival to Apple's iPhone 7. For more, let's check in with our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Ina Fried is senior editor of mobile at Recode. She joins us from San Francisco. Hi, Ina.
Hey there.
And this is just incredible what's happened over the last few days at Samsung. What more do we know about why Samsung decided to take this drastic move and just end production?
I think at this point there was really no other choice for them. Even if they identified the cause of this problem in the second set of phones, I don't think either its customers or the people that distribute phones, retailers, carriers, would have taken a chance on a third Note model. So I think at this point they made the only decision they could, which is to cut their losses, which will be significant, but cut their losses here.
And when we say end production, it's not just that. They're also pulling marketing and sales and recalling millions of the devices that people already have.
Right. So they had already recalled the original set of devices, and they'd issued some undetermined number of replacement models, but probably also in the millions. And those are now also being encouraged. It's not an official recall yet. I suspect it will be. But both Samsung and the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission are saying, turn off those replacement phones, don't use them, and return them to where you got them.
And what was the underlying problem, and do we know why they were unable to actually fix it that was causing these fires?
Well, it certainly was battery related. Initially, Samsung said the problems with the first group of phones were the batteries themselves, and so they switched suppliers, and the replacement phones had a different battery. It's unclear whether there was a second problem, a separate problem, or if the original problem went beyond the batteries themselves. But when we take a step back, I mean, the real issue here is you're packing an incredible amount of energy into a small space, and the tolerances are pretty thin. I mean, one of the reasons I think we haven't heard other electronics makers gloating too much is everyone in the industry knows they could have a battery problem at some point. I mean, these are just an incredible amount of energy in a small space.
But are the batteries that Samsung has been using very different from the batteries that, for example, Apple uses? Because we haven't heard about Apple phones catching on fire in this way.
Right. I mean, the technology is the same, lithium ion. But, every battery and battery connection is designed pretty much uniquely for that particular smartphone. Because battery life is so important to us on our phones, every inch that isn't used, every millimeter that isn't used by the phone designer for electric components goes to battery. So typically, they design that battery to fill up every amount of available space. And, again, I think this hasn't happened to other electronics makers in the same way. We have seen other battery-related problems, other charger-related problems with other electronics in the past. This is certainly the biggest and most widespread problem.
Meanwhile, Ina, there is a big Samsung challenge today. The Supreme Court is hearing oral arguments in a major patent case, Apple versus Samsung. Tell us about that and what's at stake there.
So this is the first of many patent disputes between Apple and Samsung. The one that went through the trial the first, Apple was awarded nearly $1 billion in damages. This relates to about 400 million of that are related to design patents. So not the patents on how the phone works, but the patents on how the phone looks. And this is the first time in over a century that the Supreme Court has looked at a design patent case. The question here is how much should somebody found to infringe have to pay? Historically, it's been the total profits on the entire device. Samsung argues that's way too much, that if the example they love to use, if a car is found to have an infringing cup holder, the profits for the entire car could be at risk. And that's, at a smaller scale, what Samsung says is happening to it here.
And what is Apple saying?
Well, Apple's saying two things. One, that is the standard, that it's the entire device. And Apple's case in this case was that essentially Samsung was ripping off the look and feel and the functionality of the iPhone. So Apple's making the case that actually, you know, in addition to being an appropriate remedy generally, specifically in this case, Apple is alleging that, and, you know, a jury agreed that Samsung was infringing on the iPhone as a whole.
When you take that case and what we were talking about earlier and Samsung ending production of the Galaxy Note 7, what is the state right now, just in the 30 seconds we have left, of the rivalry between these two companies? Who's winning?
Well, it's a pretty fierce rivalry. I mean, I would say Apple's had a better last couple months for sure. I mean, the patent case, I think actually you could make the case Samsung won in the sense that, you know, it was allowed to keep selling the phones. In the Note thing, I mean, clearly Samsung, you know, is losing a lot and going to have a lot of work to rebuild its reputation.
That's Ina Fried, senior editor of Mobile for Recode, joining us from San Francisco. A lot of news, a lot of bad news for Samsung, but then, of course, that case as well being heard at the Supreme Court. Ina, thanks so much as always.
Thanks.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.